McClellan. McWhorter. Minto. Sotelo Solis. Roberts.
Here.
Salas.
Here.
Sankey.
Here.
Saf.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the regular meeting of the Board of Directors of the San Diego Metropolitan Transit System. And first item of business is the approval of minutes for April 13th. And if there's no comment, I'll take a motion on that from Bragg's second. Ms. Cole, no further discussion. All in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you. We have a number of public comments, and I'm afraid that we're only going to be able to take five of them, and the rest of the public comments will have to take place after the rest of the agenda, which is our rule here. So I will call the first three folks who, or first five folks, I should say, who have registered, and the first speaker this morning is Lewis Pruitt, followed by
Martha Welch.
Martha Welch. Mr. Pruitt.
Good morning. My name is Luis Puentes, and I'm here on behalf of Bus 83. I ride that bus every day in the morning. That's all my comments. Thank you.
Okay. I guess I took you out of order. What was your name?
Luis Puentes.
Okay, Mr. Puentes. Let me see if I have your name down here. Yes, I have it. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Lewis Pruitt, and I want to talk to everybody about talking about the 901 Express. It would be good to have the 901 Express because, for one, it would kind of break down the monotony of what's going on. If you could use the 901 Express, it would be Monday through Fridays, and it'd only be 2 days a week. It'd be 12 in the afternoon and 5 in the afternoon. 12 in the afternoon just to break up the monotony, 5 in the afternoon just to stop the get through the rush hour. And instead of the bus going through Coronado, once it gets to Cesar Chavez, it'll go on the expressway, go all the way down to Palm Avenue, get off on Palm Avenue, and it'll be back on track when it gets to 9th and Palm. But the 901 Express would be very good. If it would be a good, give it a 6 months trial, it would really help out the city of Imperial Beach and San Diego if you'd give it a try. Just 5 days a week, weekends and holidays, you don't have to worry about it. But just like the 150, the 901 Express would be really good to use if everybody look into it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pruitt. Martha Welch, and we're followed by Callie McLaughlin.
Martha Welch, I'm here to talk about the trolley today. We have a problem with walking in trolleys. We don't get it. Right now it's new, old, and new. Sometimes in the blue, on the rush hours, yesterday, on the trolley, at 24th, there was an electric problem, and the new one, the old one, in the middle. What happened? Everybody has to get out. And then he calls the doors and goes away. Next one, where it crashes like that. I've seen it a lot of times when you call the up there in the turn, you know, up there. Sometimes the old ones break down also. So what's going on? We promise we don't get that. Now, if the bathrooms in this building is only but it's only 9, 8 to 5 and no weekends. Now, I've seen the budget, 15, I saw the budget. You, $30 million for El Cajon and also in 30 for some places down there. But I know I've been to that station in El Cajon, and nothing's happened, the same as it ever was. Now, I was expecting lights and an escalator and bathrooms, but we don't have that right now. It's the same as ever what it did. Now, what's going on in 15? There's a thing called elevator. Where does it stop and where does it end? It looks like it doesn't have an end. It's crazy. It's like wasting money. Also, the blue line down south, all the signs, you know, it says going to UCSD. That's not true. It doesn't go to there. It goes to the plaza. We know about that. And how are you going to do the other trolley? I don't see anything going up there. It's not working what you do with the trolley. You're wasting money somehow because you had the money. I was in the meeting with Sandag, and they were supposed to be building that trolley to up there, but it's not going there. So where's the money? Where's it going? It's not clear to me or anybody else what you're doing here with your stuff. I've seen the 901. It turns on 10th, you know? And what does it say, 992? And then it changed to 901. So on Broadway, what does it say, 901 or 922? It's not clear to me. What do you do with the 901? I don't know.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Callie McLaughlin, followed by Tina Scott.
Good morning. My name is Callie McLaughlin. I'm here to talk about Bus 83. I work at the Meeting Place Clubhouse in Mission Hills. The Meeting Place is a center for adults with mental health disorders to come and volunteer and achieve recovery through work. Many of our members rely on Bus Line 83 on a daily basis to get their mental health needs met at the clubhouse. The majority of our members do not drive or have stopped driving due to their mental illnesses. The 83 bus stops right outside the Meeting Place, and without it, these members would have a much harder time getting to and from our program. So I ask you to please reconsider cutting off this line of public transportation for adults with mental health disorders. Thank you.
Thank you. And Tina Scott.
Hi, I'm Tina Scott, and I am a member of the Meeting Place where Callie works.
Excuse me, Ms. Scott, could you move the microphone over closer
to
your mouth?
I'm sorry.
Thank
there,
you.
I'm Tina Scott, and I'm a member of the Meeting Place where Callie works. And I'm speaking on behalf mainly of my neighbor, who is also a member of the Meeting Place. She's out of town, Jackie, this week. But she takes the number 83 five times a week, Monday through Friday, and sometimes on Saturday. She has a difficult time walking, especially hills, because of her sciatica. I'm saying it wrong. Sciatica, yes, thank you. And the number 83 bus stops a half block away from the Meeting Place. The other bus routes, which would be an alternative when the 83 is discontinued, the number 11 and then the Middletown trolley, are both long walks with hills. And if any of you know the Laurel Street Hill at State, you know how steep it is. So also on the Route 83 is a board and care where many of the members use the 83. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's our final public speaker in the first part of the meeting, and the rest of the public speakers will have an opportunity to talk at the end of the meeting. We'll go now to the consent agenda, which is item 6 through 15. Does anyone wish to pull any of those items? If not, I'll take a motion from Mr. McWhorter, seconded by Mr. Minto. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much. We have no closed session. We're going to take item 30 next instead of 25 so that we can get through that particular item. So Sharon is here to make the report. Sharon.
Good morning. I'm going to update you on what has happened since the last board meeting with regards to AB 805. It was amended April 20th, and originally I was going to present to you the changes that were put in place on April 20th. But in fact, there have been other amendments that have been submitted to us. They're in draft form. They have not been published yet, but I'm understanding that they will be published Friday or Monday of this week. Or in the upcoming week. So the AB 805 was heard in local government and in the Transportation Committee. It did pass out of each of those in support. We did register support with amendments, and then it's been referred to Appropriations Committee with a hearing set for May 17th. As I mentioned, the author has submitted to us the draft amendments that will be going to Appropriations, so we'll discuss the bill with that in mind today. With regard to the sales tax aspect of the bill, this was to authorize MTS to be able to levy a sales tax for transit purposes. We have registered support on that aspect because the board has given us that direction. But I did want to bring up that the Board of Equalization has submitted an analysis to the Assembly, a very detailed analysis of the bill. They say multiple times in the analysis that they're not taking a position on the bill, but because they are the ones that will have to contract with MTS if we are to levy a tax and it's successful, they did want to weigh in with some challenges they foresee. The Board of Equalization currently does administer 257 separate district taxes throughout the state, all of which have distinct jurisdictional boundaries, either a city or a county boundary. It would be precedent setting, in their viewpoint, if we were to go forward with a sales tax as AB 805 envisions, because we don't have a distinct jurisdiction. We have our own jurisdictional lines, but we share the unincorporated areas of the county with North County Transit District. So they would have a hard time in separating out the two sections of the unincorporated county. They also expressed concerns that there would be some confusion amongst businesses who are operating within the unincorporated area, not knowing which district tax would apply to them, as well as in some of the cities, whether or not the MTS district tax would apply, or the NCTD, if they pass one, would apply. So those were the things that they did express concerns about, and I just wanted to raise that with you because that may become a challenge for us as we move forward in support of this aspect of the bill. With regard to the governance aspects of AB 805, as again, we're going to speak with regard to the unpublished amendments. Those amendments reinstate the tally vote here at MTS with a weighted vote to be called by at least three jurisdictions. So it also reinstates that three jurisdictions and 51% of the votes are needed in order to prevail under the weighted vote scenario. And it also limits the City of San Diego's weighted vote to 50%. So that's basically bringing it back to what we currently have in statute, with the exception that right now only two jurisdictions are required to call the weighted vote. It's kind of semantics since three jurisdictions are needed to actually pass it. It also has a board chair to be elected from the 15 members of the board. So it would be an elected official that currently serves on the board. It removes MTS's ability to appoint a non-elected official to this post, and it gives Chula Vista a second member. So that maintains the 15 members of the board. The vote would be on a two-thirds vote, and currently under our statute, we have an exemption for this particular decision from the weighted vote. In order to build consensus from the board members, that exemption is removed under AB 805. So it would be a tally vote, and then if there was a weighted vote called, it would be two-thirds of the weighted vote. And then finally, it designates a four-year term for the chair, which we currently designate a four-year term, but our chair is not a sitting member of a city council or a mayor, and so the 4 years, while it might be convenient for a non-elected official to serve as chair for 4 years, you may consider whether or not you want to continue with a four-year term. So in addition to those changes, the mayors of Chula Vista and San Diego still are designated as the appointees for their cities, in addition to the other city council members. What they have done, though, is the amendments have changed back towards splitting the votes equally amongst the members. So the four members of the City Council of San Diego would each get 12.5%, And then the weighted vote for Chula Vista would be split 50-50 between the two designees. It also, the amendments are also going to revert back to what is in current statute with regards to the county appointment. And so the county's appointee would be one of the two districts that have the greatest percentage of area in the incorporated area of the county. Again, that's same as today. So what has changed from our current statute with these new amendments? So the board chair would be chosen from the board itself. There would be no exemption from the weighted vote. The second member for Chula Vista is also new. The mayors of Chula Vista and San Diego must serve. Again, right now it's up to those two cities to determine who they want to appoint to their city as their city members, but this would be a change. Calling for the weighted vote requires three jurisdictions, not just two. And then MTS is authorized to create a sales tax measure in its entire jurisdiction. The question I have, because we were asked to bring forward alternatives by our executive committee to you today to have this discussion, would the board want any of this amended, any of these changes? And so I'll leave that out there. But in addition, some other areas for consideration, should the board be able to select the term for the chair? Again, do you want a four-year term? Should the board determine they would prefer a two-year term? Or nothing designated in the legislation at all? Should a provision be added to prevent conflict of interest? And this relates to the Attachment A matrix item that is in your packet. It's item number 4. This was raised by General Counsel some time ago with regard to whether or not we want to put a provision in our enabling legislation to prevent conflict of interest when a sitting board member has a city action that they'll have to take subsequent to the MTS action. And then finally, should we continue to advocate for the ability to levy a tax in a portion of MTS's jurisdiction? That was the direction that the board gave us a couple months ago, and that was with the intent that we would want to fashion a sales tax measure that would have its greatest likelihood of passing. And so I leave these items out there for you for your consideration.
That completes your report?
Yes.
I'll entertain any questions for clarification, but I do have a number of speakers, so we'll go to them before we get into a discussion. Are there any questions for clarification for Sharon? Yeah, Mayor Salas?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you if you could elaborate on this. Should the provision be added to prevent the conflicts of interest? I really don't understand that portion of it.
Yeah, this would be in the event that, for instance, I'll give you an example of how this came up. Some time ago, the city of San Diego had been entertaining the thought of having a Chargers stadium here on Imperial Avenue and had discussed the option of whether or not they had the ability to get the property from MTS, where we have our bus yard. And so the question from the staff at the city was, would we be able to, you know, exert our 4 votes on the city, on the MTS board in that exchange, meaning that they would then be able to act to take the property on behalf of the city of San Diego. And so the question is, do we want something that would prevent that kind of an action to be taken in the event that there is that kind of a conflict where the city is going to benefit from the action directly through some kind of a contract with MTS?
And I can address this further. So this has just always been this thing that's been hanging out there for me of when I've been asked as general counsel to look at this issue, what can I say? Yes, they're allowed to do this. No, they're not allowed to. And currently the way that our statute is written, so this exists today. It's not a product of AB 805. There is no restriction on any of you board members voting on both sides of a transaction. So you can vote here on a transaction with your city, and you can go to your city. And the same thing actually applies for adverse matters like litigation. So I've been asked before, is a board member allowed to sit in on a closed session that their city might be involved in and might be adverse to MTS on? And the advice that I have to give is there's no restriction in the law that prevents that. The only restriction is that board members have to keep closed session matters confidential. So, you know, that requires kind of this HATS and what, you know, information they take from one closed session discussion. If they go then have a closed session discussion or an open session discussion with their counsel, are the comments that they're making kind of disclosing what the discussion at MTS has? And so that's a personal decision that each board member has to make. And most often that board member voluntarily recuses themselves and sits out of the closed session because they know that they will be participating at their city. And so I haven't had that hard decision of having to say, no, I'm not allowed to tell this person they can't sit in on it. And so that, you know, was an issue. The original AB 805 draft that had taken away the three-member jurisdiction for the weighted vote kind of exacerbated that a little bit, because right now no one city could force something through at MTS. You know, you would have to have a minimum of three cities to go along, and so that's already a little bit of a check and a balance to, you know, potentially not three cities would decide to, you know, do something that's against MTS's, you know, fiscal interests. And this, you know, taken to the extreme, it was, what if somebody told us to sell a piece of property to a city for a dollar, you know, and left that budget hole for MTS to fill while, you know, clearing up a budget hole or an issue at that city. And so in those discussions, I had done various research. There are some statutes that have boards like this where the statute specifically says a board member cannot vote on a contract with their member agency. And the fact that MTS doesn't have that means the legislature knew that and decided not to. So it's really just out there for the board to understand and consider, and whether or not you're comfortable with the kind of check and balance of the three members on the weighted vote, or if, because our statute is being amended now, you want to consider some sort of additional, you know, conflict of interest provision.
Well, I think as board members, when we come to MTS, our primary responsibility is to MTS. While you're representing the, you know, your city and the interests of your city, you know, it's the MTS board that's your fiduciary responsibility. So if there's an opportunity within this bill, you know, to strengthen the checks and balances and actually, you know, speak directly to the conflict of interest, I think that that would be a healthy thing. And I don't know if other board members agree with that.
Thank you, Chair. Question for Karen. I concur in general with exactly what you're saying, Mary. Thank you. Is there any FPPC guidance on this? You said you did some research on some case law. Is there any FPPC guidance on this for us?
Not specifically, because FPPC deals with personal financial interests. And so, you know, none of you are considered, you know, your role at the city, even if you get paid at the city, is not considered a disqualifying personal financial interest. And so it's really just those agency-to-agency conflicts. And normally, we don't have them, you know, and when we vote on things here, we do often vote on things where it's a contract, because we may be funding something in a city, but it's something that all of MTS is in favor of, and it's kind of routine, and so we haven't ever said you as a board member need to abstain from that vote. You know, this certainly would require us to kind of make a note, you know, of not just things where we truly are adverse to your member city. We probably would have a practice, if one of our agenda items was approving a request from a city to distribute funds to them, that city, you know, member would probably be marked as abstaining. And so it's just, I mean, it's certainly, it's always one of those complicated things for me, because I don't have a good, clear answer for people. And but it hasn't been an issue. It's more those extremes of, like, what if there was some big issue there and, you know, it was more of a strategic thing to take a resource from MTS. It's like, what control do we have? We don't, you know, that would be a political issue. So to the extent that any of you wanted that, you know, check in there.
I guess as a layman, I view it as if MTS ever gets into an adversarial situation with one of its member cities, the conflict, I think, comes if a representative on MTS attempts to sit on both sides of the table, especially where litigation is involved. And up till now, we haven't had that problem, because the individuals who have been involved when a situation has come up, and it's rare, of course, have voluntarily recused themselves. And And what we're really seeking here, I think, is a clarification that makes it clear so everybody understands the circumstances under which that comes into play.
So just another question, sure. Then. I'm hearing that, you know, the scenarios where this would happen would be extremely rare, and that we're talking about what-if situations. So do you think that, you know, those remote possibilities are something that we should ask for the clarification then?
Personally, yes. And Mr. Roberts, I think, would like to follow up on it.
First of all, I think this aspect of the bill is positive. And I think we think it's only going to come with sort of a big charger deal. That's not the case. We have ownership of a lot of properties that are distributed really throughout the district. And it's not as it has happened on a number of occasions where maybe a representative of a city would like to make a commercial deal or affordable housing deal or any one of a number of things, sees an opportunity to utilize MTS property at something less than market rate to further some goal either that they have personally or that their city has, but they're representing the city in some cases. Many cases, I don't think the cities have taken a position on these things, but we have individuals and they're, you know, I've seen it happen from more than one city here over time that would like that. And I think that's a problem. I don't think that they should be participating in a closed-door session determining if we want to make a deal and how much we want to sell it for. And I agree with you. You should have a fiduciary responsibility to MTS while you're here and participating. But that's kind of an idealistic way to look at it. And I think it's clearer to have this identified as a conflict and say you don't participate in that aspect if this is at the request of your city. Okay, if we're committed to transit when we're in here, that's the way it ought to work. And rather than, letting somebody decide and interpret for themselves when they have a conflict, I think it should be clarified.
Mr. Chair. Hi.
Yes.
Thank you for the clarification, and thank you, Member Salas, for bringing it up. Again, to just echo the sentiment, it's been a lot of what ifs, and it hasn't happened yet, and so we're kind of looking to things for the future. And I know our attorney has always said, let's err on the side of caution. You know, as the voting member, you know, recuse yourself if you're within the 900 feet or, you know, the 850 feet of a project. You know, let's make sure that you can step away from the item. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the conflict of interest. However, again, there's a lot of what ifs, and it hasn't happened yet. So I don't know where the flavor is of the rest of my colleagues to really move this forward. And would it be in the form of a motion to go as an amendment, or just kind of what the flavor is? And even with looking at the votes, we're one person, and you have to get a number of other people's, even with the weighted vote, you have to have persuaded several other members of the dais to go on board with your item. So I, again, just where my colleagues are at with this, what ifs, the err on the side of caution, which is already happening, and you have to appeal to your colleagues to, get people on board if you were to have stayed on and voted, you know, for said item. Again, I'm putting it in what ifs. To pass, so yeah, it's.
Well, I think it's a question of taking an active role, and yet being a decider or influencing the decision on both sides of the fence. You know, or I should say the table. Where we are at this moment, and let me clarify. You have discussion topics or possible amendments. And this is something that, that has not been brought to the attention of Assemblywoman. And so what we're trying to do now is we haven't really, as a board, petitioned the Assemblywoman on specific items. A lot of these, basically the amendments up to this point, have been by word of mouth, and somewhat discussion by individuals and by her appearance here at the board. So this is sort of the last bite of the apple in our opportunity to make it clear what we as a board would like to have if it hasn't already been covered in the amendments that we know about. Mr.
Chairman,
Alvarez.
Can I just clarify for, you know, to the extent that the board wants to discuss this, I was asked executive committee to come up with potential amendments, and I have two sentences that if the board wanted to consider it, was what we would propose. So I think I should read that to you so that then you can discuss it with that in mind.
Thanks.
Which would be adding to our statute a statement that says, a board member shall not vote upon any contract between the board and the member's appointing agency, and a board member shall not participate in any closed session of the board involving a matter adverse to the member's appointing agency. So it'd be those two sentences. The first sentence is modeled after the language for the County Water Authority. The closed session one was just, that's a question that has come up with me frequently from board members asking if they can and cannot participate. And so I added that in there. So that would be for the board to discuss if that would be a direction you wanted to go, if you think it's fine the way it is now, if there's a different change.
So my question is, what is the definition of adverse? I heard Mr. Roberts talk about affordable housing projects and sale of property that could be, for the most part, is in the city of San Diego. Would then that not allow the city of San Diego members to vote on an item of a sale of property, if that's the case, completely opposed to this change? I think if it's a closed session that's directly impacted in me on my city council, I'm going to be taking a position or be hearing it and taking a vote on that. That's different. And so I don't think you've prepared with enough detail what the different situations could be that you're describing could happen. And so I would not be interested in supporting any changes at this time until there's more clarity on that, on what exactly we're talking about. That's my thoughts. That's the first time I hear those two sentences. And I don't know what the definitions of those two are. So not comfortable with adopting changes, and I don't know what they're going to mean.
Okay, and I just, the County Water Authority, that is interpreted as directly you are contracting with. So your city is a party to the transaction. So not involved in some regulatory land use zoning way. It's very strict of you're entering into a contract where MTS is a party and the city is a party. And then the same thing on if they're closed session, it would have to be either adverse in litigation or the opposite side of a real estate transaction.
But so city council members in San Diego also are on the Housing Commission. The Housing Commission is often a party to affordable housing deals. We have jurisdiction over that. What does that mean?
To date, we haven't been a party to a transaction. There might have been peripheral agreements that you sign, but we've and so it would have, if the Housing Commission was directly the developer, that would trigger that clause. If the housing, for other minor ones, those are staff, like just as an example, the AmCal affordable housing that we recently did at 62nd Street in Encanto, MTS approved that deal. We did a transaction with a developer. So the parties to that real estate transaction were MTS and the developer. There were then, because the developer had some Housing Commission funds and loans, there were a couple of covenants that we as staff approved as part of that transaction, of that we understood that the development that they were doing, they were using affordable housing funds, and so they had to contract to maintain those affordable housing covenants for the period of time of the loan. That wasn't, those ancillary agreements weren't necessarily directly before the board. The board approved the transaction with the developer and then authorized the CEO to sign any necessary documents to complete the transaction.
Mr. Roberts.
Yeah, let me help you, because it has happened, number one. And it happened, I can cite a specific example where we had a council member from a a non-City of San Diego city, and we had property, and there was a council member who was desirous of seeing that property developed. It was important to him personally. I don't know if it was important to the city council, because I don't think they ever took a position on it, but he participated in all of the closed-door sessions and was very interested in making a deal with a private developer at something less than market rate. I think that's exactly the kind of thing that we don't want to see happening.
If that was a personal interest, that's a violation of FPPC. That's not...
Would that be a violation?
Because if it's a personal interest matter?
No, he wasn't. He didn't have a financial interest. Oh. He had a political interest.
Okay. As do all of us, I think.
Well, the fact of the matter is, if you're here representing MTS, that should be your priority. If you're bringing something here that you're going to say, let's dispose of MTS property because there's something I'd like to see happening in my jurisdiction, and I'll do that at less than a market rate, or I'll attempt to do it, and I'll participate in the discussions. That's where I see this as being able to draw a line, whether Karen's language is the language or whether the language in the bill is the language. This should have been, I think this needs to be addressed no matter whether there's a bill or not.
Mr. Ramsey.
Yeah, I tend to agree, and a general counsel points out conflict of interest. To boil it down, though, to a couple sentences, obviously it's a bit too simple. I mean, there's perceived, actual, potential conflicts of interest. There's a variety of conflicts of interest, and I think we're trying to encompass and to deal with them all at one time, which we really can't. Are we really trying to regulate perceived conflict of interest? Because everyone here has an interest in protecting their city, period. So everything that we do is to protect our city, but also simultaneously to make sure that we're protecting the MTS. So that's perception, perceived conflict of interest. Potential, that could be basically every decision that we make, whether it's directly or indirectly. If we're trying to regulate or trying to set expectations, set guidelines for actual conflict of interest, that's probably easier because we can actually define it. So what I would like to see is more detailed analysis of its applicability and the extent of any proposed conflict of interest language, and perhaps some examples. Like you see in the statute with the annotated versions to show the extent of what it looks like. I just think that we're trying to deal with something that's pretty broad and big and pretty important, and we're trying to regulate also our fiduciary responsibilities to MTS and to our cities at the same time. So personally, I'd like to see more of an analysis, a much more in-depth analysis, before I can make a decision.
Chair Mathis, if I may.
Ms. Cohen. Sure.
Our enabling statute frequently has something in there that will say this will be set into policy by the board through ordinance or through board policy or whatever. So, you know, the language in our enabling statute sometimes is just kind of brief, and then it tells you to then go back and set policy at the board level to flesh that out. So that would be an alternative if you wanted to, incorporate something like this, but then say, and the board shall pass an ordinance to explain this policy or whatever. I don't know. Karen, maybe you can
Ms. Gomez.
Yeah, I'm based on the last comment, are we precluded from doing something like that now?
I would have to have Karen.
No, I mean, I think if you had adopted an ordinance or a board policy, then that would be something if people asked, are so-and-so allowed to vote on that? You could point to that and say no. Like right now, there's nothing, and so it's up to just individual situation, individual case by case,
So it seems like we're having this, it seems like this conversation needs further discussion, that we should actually have a focused discussion about that and come up with a proposal. If nothing precludes us from having that discussion and implementing a policy, then we should move in that direction in the future and not tie it to the bill.
Yeah, I mean, the only...
So I would be interested in doing that.
Yeah. I would potentially recommend if we wanted to ask for just a statement that said the board, you know, in the voting section, that the board, you know, may, you know, adopt by ordinance further, you know, policies to address, you know, conflicts of interest, which that limits because you don't, like, the statute gives each of you voting rights. So we can't necessarily strictly restrict those, but if it acknowledges that the board itself can establish those policies and if all of you vote for them, then that would leave it. We couldn't get too in-depth. I mean, the conflict of interest policy, I don't think can be, even if it's adopted at the board level, couldn't be so restrictive that it takes away your core voting rights. So.
Like I said, it just seems like the conversation needs further discussion and further evolution of this, yes. That I wouldn't want to make reference to the bill when we don't even know where we're going with it. Mm-hmm. If that conversation seems like we're allowed to continue it, give it more thought, come back with just a specific item in the agenda, continue cultivating it where we all feel comfortable and there's clear direction, I am good with that. Making reference to the bill and something that it's a bit vague, I am not okay with.
Mr. Chairman, I think we ought to go to speaker slips. You never know, we might have a good idea that comes out of it. And we can move this along.
I'll second that. That's a point of order. I don't think we can make any decisions until we hear from the public first.
All right.
Thank you.
Hearing that, we then will go to the speakers. And my first speaker under this item is Jasmine Zafra. And that'll be followed by Maria Cortez. And I ask Ms. Cortez to be ready to step up as soon as she's done. Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay, good morning. My name is Hazmin Zafra, and I'm here representing Mid-City CAN and the Improving Transportation City Heights team. I wanted to express my full support for AB 805 today and to urge the board to vote in support of the bill as it currently stands. What we really are asking for is to have a SANDAG and MTS that represents the needs of this region and that accurately takes into consideration those that are most affected by public transportation. I think we all saw with Measure A an example of what happens when the deciding boards are not in touch with the needs of the community and are making decisions that do not reflect what their constituents really are asking for. The communities that most use public transportation don't get their voices heard enough, and AB 805 takes necessary steps to ensure that this is corrected and that there is accountability and oversight for these boards. Thank you very much, and I hope that you listen to the rest of the comments as well.
Thank you. Ms. Cortez, followed by Gretchen Newsom.
Hi, my name is Maria Cortez. I am also here with Mid-City CAN for ITCH, Improving Transportation in City Heights. Yes, it says City Heights, but it's not only just for City Heights, it's for all of San Diego, eventually throughout the county, throughout the state. I am in support with MTS. Yes, I'm wearing my transit shirt because finally, after 35 years, that center line, which is on the I-15, I would like to thank MTS for doing this. And also, when we go to Sandag, that my dream finally is going to come true. It's just the beginning. I hear my purple line is going to be coming through. Hopefully, I don't have to come in ashes. But I just want to say thank you. I support the AB 805 as it is because we are in the underserved communities that use a lot of the transportation here in City Heights. And so the decisions that you guys make, it affects all of us. And I just would like to say that I am in support of the AB 805 with the way that it stands. I, too, would like to hear further conversations about the new changes that have happened. But let's start working together now, because we as a community stand together with MTS. We want the community to see that MTS is with us on transportation. Yes, we do have some issues, but we're willing to work that out. We want you to know that you can also depend on us, the community. And thank God that Proposition A did not pass, because we know what would happen if the money would go into the general fund, because general fund usually means that we have the money now, but when we need it, it's not there, and we don't know where the money went. But I think this is a step in the right direction. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Gretchen Newsom, followed by Julio Rivera. Julio, please be ready to go.
Gretchen Newsom, representing IBEW 569 and our 3,400 members, the Electricians Union, also representing the Quality of Life Coalition, which is a diverse coalition of environmentalists, labor, community activists, community organizations, social justice organizations. The momentum continues as our coalition grows in support of AB 805. Here today to recommend and encourage your continued support of AB 805. I think that Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher should be commended for graciously incorporating many of the amendments that you brought up as concerns, including your concerns related to the selection of the chair and the vice chair, the weighted vote, and the mayoral requirement for membership. Many of those amendments have been incorporated and will continue to be incorporated. I do find it striking today's conversation. I'm glad that we are asked to speak now at this moment. Related to a supposed conflict of interest. And when I look at the minute or the agenda materials, the alternatives related to a conflict of interest that are being proposed to you, in my mind, weaken the needed reform that is being brought forward by AB 805. Alternatives that are suggested include changing the voting structure of AB 805 to limit San Diego. We've already seen some of these limits to San Diego. Returning to the current voting structure, i.e. no reform. And then regardless of the voting structure, including a provision that a board member cannot vote on a contract between MTS and the member's agency and cannot participate in closed session involving a matter adverse to the member's agency, again, limiting your ability to stand up and lead and to provide the needed reform that is necessary for our communities in order to receive the mass transit that they so desperately need. Again, I encourage you to support AB 805 and continue to do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker, as you know, Julio Rivera, represents Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher. So take some extra time if you need it.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Mathis. And good morning, Board. Thank you for having us again. I, again, want to thank you for your support of this legislation at your previous meeting. We listened, we heard, we took a lot of your concerns into account. As Sharon Cooney went over some of the amendments that we've placed into the legislation, we are reinstating the tally vote. We are leaving the selection of the chair to a two-thirds vote of the board. We're limiting the weighted vote of San Diego to 50%, along with some other changes to it. I did want to point out that there was one small drafting error on page six, slide six, I guess. So calling for the weighted vote requires three jurisdictions, not two, just two. The intent was actually to leave it as is, so not changing the mechanism for calling for the weighted vote. So just leaving it the way that it currently operates. And although I will say that it sounds like the discussion about the conflict of interest codes is one that's worthy of more discussion, it sounds like that's something that the board would be able to do on its own in a future action. So I would encourage you to continue supporting this bill with amendments that have already been incorporated. Thank you.
Although I think this might be appropriate, since you represent the Assemblywoman, that if there are any questions from the board for Julio for clarification. Seeing none, thank you, Julio. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Sotelo-Solis.
One or a two-year bill?
Currently, it's a one-year bill.
1 year. Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I wanted a clarification. So you're saying we're basically using the current procedure in accordance with the bill that we have now for a weighted vote call, and then the three jurisdictions which must concur in validating it?
Yes, that's the intent.
Okay, so there's no change there. All right, thank you.
Yeah, the main change, I think, would be adding a member through the Chula Vista City Council.
I'm sorry, what?
The biggest change, I think, to the whole voting structure would probably be adding that second member from the City of Chula Vista. But the weighted vote would continue as is.
Okay, thank you. Our next speaker is Carolina Rodriguez Junta, followed by Michelle Krug.
Good morning, MTS Board. My name is Carolina Rodriguez Adjunta. I'm here with Climate Action Campaign. And I just want to thank you for providing the opportunity to comment on AB 805. And I also want to state that Climate Action Campaign fully supports AB 805, and we urge the board to support it as is, given that the assembly member definitely took into account all the considerations that were brought up at the last board meeting. So definitely want to commend her for that. And just ask the board to support it as is, even though the discussions around some of the previous things that were mentioned are fruitful. And I just want to reiterate that at Climate Action Campaign, one of our main pillars is stopping climate change and improving our quality of life, and giving MTS the ability to go straight to the voters is really a game changer for this agency, and giving MTS the ability to raise funds outside of the constraint of SANDAG, where we've known time and time again cars really hold the spotlight, and public transit, active transportation are lessened in profile. So again, we just urge you to support this bill as is, to really address the transportation needs of our city and our county, excuse me. And we also are glad to see that there's more representation from the city of Chula Vista with a second board member on the governance of this board. Thank you.
Thank you. If there's anybody else that has a cell phone here that hasn't turned it off or put it in vibrate, you know, please take care of that. Thank you. Michelle Krug, and you'll be followed by Randy Van Vleck.
Good morning. I also want to encourage that we support AB 805 as it stands, and I concur with Gretchen Newsom saying I think that this body should be giving accolades of appreciation to the Assemblywoman for graciously, and I repeat that word, graciously incorporating as many of the amendments as she has into that bill just from that one conversation that she had while she was here. As far as the conversation that is going to continue about areas of conflict, I personally really want my city to be able to vote. I'm electing these representatives, and these representatives are serving on this body to represent me. And to say that if the city of San Diego has a particular interest and they cannot vote within a closed session, that doesn't make sense to me. That is exactly where they should be voting, because again, it's a body that's making the decision as a body. Nobody is doing it just as one person, but I don't think that they should be disenfranchised. Another example of that is in National City, when MTS owns the National City Adult School, and we went through a lot to figure out exactly what was allowed about them subleasing property, that property, or parts of that property. I think that it's important that National City have a vote whether or not it's going to affect them. I mean, that's the whole purpose. Thank you.
Thank you. Randy Van Vleck, and you'll be followed by Paul Holloway.
Thank you for your time this morning. My name is Randy Van Vleck. I'm the Active Transportation Manager with the City Heights Community Development Corporation. We've been based in City Heights for the past 35 years, building affordable housing, new community engagement, and working with leaders like Maria Cortez on projects like the Centerline Rapid 235. And that project's been in the work, as she mentioned, for about 35 years. That's a long time to wait to have rapid transit coming up through the middle of our community. We're really appreciative and grateful for the fact that it's going to be opening this year. We really look forward to that. But it is a long time, but we hope that we can continue to implement these rapid projects much more quickly. We are in support of Assembly Bill 805, and we appreciate this board's support for it last month. This bill really is a unique opportunity that empowers MTS with the ability to pursue your own funding measure. And it's an opportunity to advance the principles of democracy by ensuring that the region's voters are more fairly represented at the decision-making table for us today. It's going to help us lift up the South of the Eight communities, which I think have been neglected for a long time. And as someone who grew up in Western Chula Vista, I know that this will help better serve our community of Chula Vista by having the extra board seat. And I think that I appreciate the Assembly Member Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher. She has definitely shown a willingness, I think, to work with this board. Was here at the last meeting, and this new set of amendments demonstrates a commitment to doing so. So I hope that you'll support Assembly Bill 805 as you did last month, and we look forward to working with you to improve transit in the region. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I mistakenly called Paul Holloway. He's here on item 25, so that was our final speaker. We can now get around to a discussion by the board. You have, of course, in front of you discussion topics or possible amendments. I'll invite Julio to come forward as necessary if anyone needs any clarification that he can help with. The first item, as you see, is the flexibility of the sales tax measures. I guess the question is, does anyone right now, 805, is it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Julio, 805 as amended gives the authority to levy tax in the entire jurisdiction only. Is there any thought about the alternatives that are listed in the discussion topics? Again, these were came forward from the executive committee. Yes, I'm sorry, Mayor Salas.
Yes. So the question is for Julio, and I know that it would be important for us to be able to identify communities of interest, not just the whole MTS jurisdiction, mm-hmm. In order to have specific transit projects. So, was the decision to have the tax measures include the whole discussion, was that driven by the input of the State Board of Equalization?
To be honest, Mayor, I believe the intent there, the reason for that is after Measure A, we saw that a lot of our southern areas were in favor of increased taxes, and so we saw MTS and North County Transit District already as subdivisions of Sandag in a way. So that's the main reason we went with those two.
Okay, but again, if we were to take the whole MTS jurisdiction to a vote on a tax, mm-hmm. Polling might show that we couldn't get that tax
right.
The tax measure passed within the whole MTS jurisdiction. So the question is then, this bill, it appears that if we were to go out with a sales tax measure, we would have to include the whole MTS jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's currently the way it's written. That's definitely something I could take back to the Assembly Member.
Yeah, so. Because I know that the State Board of Equalization weighed in that generally the tax measures are within a whole jurisdiction, and that it would be difficult to sort it out. So I'm wondering if that was a rationale that the Assemblywoman then decided to include a tax measure that would include the whole MTS jurisdiction. Yeah. I would really like to see, communities of interest being able to vote on a measure.
I think Sharon had something to add.
Yes. After the board directed us in January, the CEO and I met with the Assemblywoman about this issue, and she actually expressed interest in doing that for us in a portion of the jurisdiction. I just think that when the amendments were, just because of the scheduling of the amendments and trying to get it through the committee process, they weren't able to do that at the time. But I did have that conversation with the staff member in Sacramento this week. It was not brought to her attention ahead of time, so it wasn't incorporated at all in the amendments that we are discussing today. So if the board directs us to continue with that, ask from the Assemblywoman, then we would then also ask that as well. And I had actually opined to the staff member that possibly the Board of Equalization would be less upset about the, not upset, have less concerns about the bill if they possibly cut out the unincorporated areas, because that seems to be the big sticking point on their end.
Yeah.
But I just throw that out there as just some context for this conversation.
Mr. Roberts.
Well, I was going to point out that same issue, because it presents as the entire MTS area. It would be nice if we could tailor it down to something smaller, because we do have a problem with the unincorporated area, the East County non-incorporated, where you can't have a tax on that doesn't prevail in the rest of the county. So I think to the extent, even if we didn't have to have every city involved and you could tailor something down to a smaller sub-region of MTS, I think it would be far more beneficial.
So the question for the board, is there any further discussion? Yes, Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah, I don't want to do something, though, that leaves out the unincorporated areas. So if it was tailored so that the unincorporated area could be one of those subregions also, then that's important. Otherwise, how would they ever get an opportunity to have a vote on what comes to their region or not comes to their region?
Mr. Mayor, the problem is with the Board of Equalization, and it's just like you can't split the city of San Diego and say, because we don't want the vote north of I-8, that might be detrimental to whatever we're trying to do south of I-8. You can't do that unless the rules are changed dramatically, and you can't do that in the county.
I get that. But the unincorporated areas, I mean, why couldn't they all be a separate region, though, unto themselves in a vote? I don't know.
You need to talk to the Board of Equalization, but what they have ruled is that if you're the taxing entity, you can't subdivide that and have a different tax.
Hmm. It's just interesting that going forward with something like this, every city, incorporated city, can bring forward to have something brought to their neighborhood, so to speak, and they can vote on it. But if I live in Hamul, I will never have the opportunity to have any kind of benefit coming to my region.
No, well, you couldn't split your own city into segments.
No, I wouldn't. But what I'm saying
is... No, you can't.
I'm leaving out, you know, like Hamul or, you know, Scanso or, you know, even the unincorporated areas of Escondido, for instance.
But that, well, you're seeing it as unincorporated. That's all part of an entity. That's called the county.
Well, I realize that.
Okay, so it's no different than you not splitting off East Santee from West Santee.
I get that. I get that whole thing. It's perplexing to think that if you're not incorporated, that you're left out just because you can't split a county.
Well, the issue is that the unincorporated area is divided among NCTD and MTS.
Right.
It's not the unincorporated area as an entity. It's the fact that if MTS wanted to pass a tax, we couldn't impose that tax on NCTD's jurisdiction.
Okay.
That's the issue.
Okay.
Okay, anything else on this one? Yes. Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you. And I join Mayor Salas's concern. And I think if this has to be advocated in the entire jurisdiction of MTS, which includes Poway and a number of other different areas, it's going to thwart the very purpose of this bill. We had speaker after speaker talk this morning about reallocating or reemphasizing transit in certain areas that they have a sense have been underserved. By making a tax bill, if you will, or ordinance or a vote, the entire jurisdiction of the MTS, I can tell you, it's going to be much, much more difficult, if not impossible. If you do polling in Poway in certain regions, this would never pass. And would that be enough votes to pull it down? I don't know, but certainly it wouldn't help. So from Poway's perspective, we would not want to be the barrier to success of this legislation. And I think it clearly would be a barrier to success if they do not allow individual cities to break out and address their own constituents. And Mayor Salas would make a good argument for a transit tax that would increase transit in her city. That would be heard very well in her jurisdiction, but perhaps not the rest of the city. So I, for one, would move or advocate for this board to continue the discussions with the assembly member's office to have the ability to levy the tax on a portion of the MTS jurisdiction as opposed to a total.
Well, I think rather than continue the discussion, just say that we'd like to see that in the bill. I think is where we are in this discussion, and that's the kind of information that Julio would take back to the assemblywoman. If
all you really have to add is "or a portion thereof."
Yeah, that's right.
To the bill, and then that would give you the latitude to do whatever you wanted to do.
Yeah. So we're talking now the desirability, and Ms. Cole, you wanted to speak to this.
Yeah, I just wanted to hear also from Julio exactly a clarification of why the assembly member left the unincorporated areas out. Is there something that you can?
Sorry, to clarify, left the unincorporated areas out?
Right, because you said entire jurisdiction only, not unincorporated areas. Is that what she's?
So I think in the bill it actually includes unincorporated areas, so it would be the entire MTS service area, including the outlying.
So it does include unincorporated areas. Okay. Because
It
sounds like the discussion was saying that it did not, and we wanted to.
I think the discussion is now getting to the point where we're talking about if we do include subdivisions of MTS using, I think, existing boundaries like the city of Chula Vista or National City, that would leave out the unincorporated areas of the county.
Okay. Mr. Tellez-Ozzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a quick question for you, Julio. I know we had talked about the conflict of interest policy and having a broader discussion internally here at MTS and then possibly having something that maybe be boilerplate that could be included after, but we could do it automatically here, right? So that's one thing. We've been talking about a broader discussion. Would it be better or would it help the assembly member if we had a discussion separate and beyond regarding the BOE, because this is unique to San Diego and San Diego County, to have that discussion about this particular matter and the district tax, broader discussion? Would that help the assembly member, or how would it affect her?
And I'll say, I think this is the first time I'm hearing about the issues from the Board of Equalization. So obviously we're going to have to take a deeper dive into that and see how we might be able to address those concerns. But yeah, it's going to have to be an ongoing conversation.
And since you're mentioning it, this is the first time, how often does, and on slide 3 it says the BOE is not taking a position on the bill. How often do they take positions on, you know, the entire legislative docket of hundreds and if not thousands of bills that come before the Assembly and Senate?
Sorry, Council Member, it's not something I'd be able to answer.
But I'm just saying that they choose, you know, pick and choose which mm-hmm. ones they would actually take a stance on. By them not taking a position on a bill does not show support or opposition.
Right. I think they didn't take a position for a reason, right?
Right. Okay, thank you.
Just before we leave this, and Sharon, maybe you can help clarify. Assembly Member Todd Gloria also has a bill that addresses this specific issue.
Yes, and it was my understanding that the two assembly members hadn't discussed this prior to them submitting their separate legislation. But yes, he's has a bill that would authorize other MPOs to or other subsets of jurisdictions to go ahead and submit a tax for the ballot. So,
okay,
are you suggesting perhaps asking the two authors to work together, or?
Well, no, I was just curious if there was anything that he was doing that might help to inform us on this. I mean, it would be nice if they worked together, but it seems to me one of the points that's being missed that I think Member Cunningham suggested was that, you know, at the end of the day, there's a political consideration here. And to be able to get this down to a more desirable voting area, if you will, if it were so that you could do it city by city or some way, shape, or form, so you're more likely to get the benefits you want in the areas in which you want them, you know, for future political success. I mean, you can look at the votes of some of these things over the MTS area. It's still difficult, but it may be if three or four or five cities said, look, we want these benefits, we want this, and we want to put this on the ballot in our areas. So to be able to get it down to a smaller subdivision, so to speak, of the, and I think that's, Mayor Salas, kind of what you were getting at too, but Councilmember Cunningham made it very clear. So that if we could have an option of crafting something within the MTS area, but that doesn't necessarily, as it currently does, require the whole MTS, I think we could avoid the Board of Equalization problems and also be able to more carefully craft something for success on a future measure.
Right. And, you know, transit is a system. So it would appear to me that Chula Vista wouldn't necessarily stand alone, but that we would work with the cities of Imperial Beach and National City, Coronado, that could be a very reasonable subgroup that you could work with.
And since you have representatives on this board of all of those cities, it's just, to me, a perfect forum to be able to do something like that. So I think that I think most of us are sort of saying that in a roundabout way, that this would improve the bill.
Okay. Ms. Gomez.
Yes. Sharon, had we spoken to the Board of Equalization? I mean, we keep making reference to it.
I have the analysis that they submitted, and I know that they're in discussions with the Assemblywoman's office.
Okay.
That's the only thing.
Okay. Thank you for that.
And I mean the Assemblywoman's office in Sacramento.
Got it. That would be okay. Thank you once again. So it just seems like I'm definitely in support on making reference to the jurisdiction area to be able to be more flexible than what it currently is. It seems like I hear that there's a lot of support for that. I don't want to be too prescriptive, so I think if we can just make wording that it allow us, as we're making that decision, if we are going to move forward with that option in the future, we can do that. So whatever that is, I think that should be the discussion with the assembly member. And it seems like based on at the beginning, you said that there was initial conversations about that, and she's willing to do that. So it just seems like we should move forward with that direction and have it be.
Mr. Alvarez.
Yeah, I would. It sounds like there's interest, support in requesting an amendment to allow flexibility for the jurisdictional boundaries to change. Having worked in the legislature and former Assemblywoman Salas knows this as well. Board of Equalization taking a no position on a bill doesn't mean they're opposed to it. It doesn't mean that it can't be done, that it can't be collected through different means. It just means it's an issue that they're raising. So I would actually request that we make a motion to, or I would make a motion to continue supporting this legislation and request that the author add additional language as it pertains to the ability of jurisdictions within MTS to have the authority for the levying of a tax. I think that's what people were getting at. If that's not correct, then I'd be persuaded maybe to change that, but that would be my motion at this time.
And I will second it.
Before we get ahead of ourselves, we have other items to discuss, which can be lumped into the motion to support. But I think I want it for clarification, since the item would be, or a portion thereof, is that what you're saying, is that you're favoring, that's option one in the alternative? It's a relatively simple modification.
Correct. This is on attachment A.
Yes.
Number one.
Yes.
Alternative to AB 805 column, yes. Number one, as you've identified. Correct.
Yes. Okay.
That would be the only, I'm aware and familiar with the rest of the amendments. My motion is only including the amendments requests for number one. Sub one.
What I would like to do is vote on these separately until we get them all put to rest, and then lump them into one single motion, if that's okay. We can take a motion for this alternative and then move on to the next discussion and go right down the line. Once we have completed that action, then we can take a covering motion along the lines which you suggest.
If people are able to stay here for three more hours to do this,
no,
fine.
I don't.
Otherwise, my motion is to only to continue supporting AB 805 with the amendments that we already requested last time were adopted, and with this new request with the item number 1-1. That would be it.
You're trying to close off discussion on these other items, and I don't think I can support the motion.
We're not. This is not this is not agendized as item by item. It is only one item. If Karen wants to correct me on that.
Excuse me?
Mr. Mathis, if I may, I would like to consider the recommendations separately. I think they all warrant discussion, with all due respect. That's how it was presented to us, that we would be able to weigh in on each recommendation. So,
okay, I'm just warning people that it's going to take a long, long time. I'm willing to stay.
Well, is there a second to that motion? Okay. Any further discussion on the motion? This motion would close
quick.
Up. Pardon?
I would make sure we clarify that, because I would continue the discussion if he wants to close the meeting. I have an issue with that.
I'd clarify the motion.
I believe that the clarification is the motion speaks specifically. If you look at these items on your agenda item, the blue sheets with the matrix, as we call them, it's number one, and it would be to pursue number one in the third column on the right only.
And I think what would you agree to that, Mr. Alvarez, or what?
If everybody can stay, that's fine. I'm just warning people, it's going to take a while.
Excuse me.
Speak now or.
Just vote on it.
Well,
okay,
I cannot stay, so only until 11. So if we can get this done by 11 o'clock.
We'll get it done, yeah.
Yeah.
So if your motion is to close off discussion on the remaining items.
Yes, I want to reserve the right to continue to make the motion, but we can continue discussion. That's fine.
All right, so your motion is number one, and to close off discussion on the further items.
Continue discussion.
Continue discussion. I'm sorry. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Okay. That's the motion. No further discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. We'll move on quickly then to number two, the source of the chair. Any comments on this? Any desire to look at that one?
I do have a comment. I strongly feel that we should be able to select a chairman that is from the outside. Doesn't have to be an elected official sitting on this board. The reason why I feel that way is because I believe it's chairmanship in its purest form. We would still be the only people that chairman would be responsible to would be this constituency, this board. And I want to retain that. I've been here a long time and have seen how having outside chairmanship has proven that our resources are divided equitably. And that's important to me as a representative from a small city. And I'm not talking about current chair or current mayors of San Diego, and certainly not Chula Vista. But it, as coming from a smaller city, I am concerned that that may not continue to happen. So I would be in support of us being able to retain the capability of selecting an outside chairman. Thank you.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Gordon.
Thank you. Laura, you jumped me a little bit on that one because I wanted to bring up the same thing. One of the problems that I still feel is some of the disenfranchisement issues with some of the smaller cities. Once again, you look and, again, I agree with no offense taken to San Diego or Chula Vista, but they would have, once again, overwhelming power on this board. Only those two cities have full-time mayors and city council. None of the other ones could afford. All the mayors that I know, unless they're retired, they have jobs. So in order for them to be a chair on this board, they would have to either be retired or some other reason. So I like the idea. Any large corporation, it's nice when they, when they promote internally, but a lot of times some of the large corporations need to go outside and bring in a new set of eyes and ideas. I think that's the benefit of keeping it open where we can choose a chairman that sits outside this board. So thank you.
Any other comments on this?
Yes.
Mayor Salas.
Well, I think it speaks to a level of accountability in having the chair be elected from our own membership. And I think just the process of voting for the chair requiring a two-thirds vote of the whole board is an assurance that you're going to be able to get a chair that is agreeable to most of us. And so I think that unless I'm mistaken, this is the only regional board in which we select an outside chair, that it's not a member of the of an electorate voted by the public. And I think that it's important that that we do have this. When we have public funds, I think it's really important that the members of the deciding members of the board are elected.
Yeah, Mr. Roberts.
Yeah, just a minor point, but because I hear it mentioned all the time, and I think Randy said it a while ago, and he was talking about principles of democracy. I find it kind of curious because this would call, in the event that you had a chair from the board, city of Chula Vista have a second seat. I presume that's because Chula Vista is the second largest city, and that sort of makes sense, except for the fact that there are more people in the MTS unincorporated area than there are in the city of Chula Vista. And just kind of a curious principle of democracy.
Well, you know, the second seat really has no extra power because the vote is split.
If we're basing this on principles of democracy, as I hear it referred to, it seems like a curious sort of way to get to it. And if you really think that we should not be able to select our own chair, irregardless, it seems to me that then we ought to modify who gets that second seat. And since it has no power, then I'm assuming that you'd be in favor of doing it along democratic principles.
Well, let me say that obviously I'm the one that is affected here, and it's been a big inhibition to me because I don't want to speak as if I'm someone that's trying to keep my own job, because far from it. I would point out that the chairman has a lot of ancillary duties and responsibilities that might not be compatible with the duties and responsibilities and the time available to a member of the board. What I'm advocating is the board will ultimately make a decision, but the board should have the option if it chooses to select an outside chairman. There are a lot of things that there are press conferences, there are special events. I'll be back here at 3 o'clock this afternoon, for instance, to preside over the handing out of the laptops, something that you're all familiar with. But there are press conferences. They're presiding over special events and press conferences. And for there are just being visible to the employees to be around, to be a familiar figure, and also to be the face of MTS instead of the face of a particular council. So there, for 35 years, we've followed this principle and the continuity that we've had. We've had only two turnovers in that period, going back to Leon Williams, who served for 14 years, and for his predecessor, Jim Mills, who served for a period of time. So you had the benefit of continuity, you had the benefit of experience, and a really depth of knowledge of the business. So I guess what I'm advocating is that the board will ultimately decide whether they want to select a member or not. But to have that option so that the board can express it in that way, I think is a valuable asset to have. If the board doesn't agree that they want to do that, they want to elect from inside, then they're free to do that as well. But I think it should be a board decision and not a decision of the legislature. Ms. Gomez.
Yeah, thank you. And I have to say I must disagree with you. I do believe that the fact that we're still going to be selecting the board based on our vote, we'll have that option. I don't actually agree that the option should be somebody from an outside that is not accountable. I do think that as a government agency, it should be somebody that is elected by the people, and therefore we should have that. We're going to vote on it as a board. It's not required that they're a mayor either, so it's going to still be up to this body to select that chairmanship. And I think in any board, a chairmanship is understood that there's extra duties that are required. That doesn't change in any of the boards that I serve on. It just comes with the job. So if somebody is up for that selection, they should be aware of it from the get-go. So I honestly do not think that it should be that the option of selecting somebody that is not accountable to the masses, it should be an option. I just think it's wrong, and I wouldn't be in support of that.
Well, the option, of course, addressing your concerns about accountability, one option there is that the 15-member board at 15 votes, you could select an outside chair who doesn't vote. Mm-hmm. And that's one option. You have the benefit of continuity, but that I think settles the accountability. And you know, in many respects, the chairman of the board, who serves at the pleasure of the board, mm-hmm. is more accountable than anyone here, because if you folks don't like what the chairman is doing, you have the power to remove. That's something that that's not true in the case of any of the members here. Their accountability, of course, is to the folks who voted them into office. Here you have a fiduciary responsibility. But I consider myself, in many respects, much more accountable as chairman to you than you would be to any of your constituents.
Harry.
Having said that, yes, Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you. I think... the accountability piece of this rides on all of our shoulders. And I have a fundamental problem with a board that is going to be mandated as to how to choose their CEO and the term of their CEO, when time and again in the last 10 years I've been here, I think we have had 99% consensus on most of our votes. I think we all have our best interests of our community, but MTS in particular. And may I take this moment to repeat or to state that in my 10 years on this board, this chairman has served admirably. And it's almost like we're looking for a solution where there's no problem. Yes. The accountability is with us. and to our constituents and to our riders of our system. The having a chairman or the option, and I like the idea of the option, returning the power to this, or keeping the power to this board, who I trust and admire, giving them the option to say that we could have a CEO from the outside or the inside, depending upon the circumstances, and mandating the term. So if we want more accountability, then make the term a two-year term or a one-year term, subject to review every year. But I think Chairman Mathis' point is very well taken. If I want to remove Chairman Mathis, I just need a majority of this board. If I'm going to remove an elected official, then the ramifications of removing that elected official are significant, both for the elected official I'm removing, because I'm removing him for wrongdoing or removing the chair for a problem. So it creates a significant issue not only for the current CEO, but also for all of us. It's very uncomfortable to do so. So a CEO of a company in the real world is controlled by the board of directors. By having an outside or the opportunity for an outside CEO, we maintain that control, we maintain that continuity, and we maintain the ability to remove the chair at any moment without significant problems. I don't have a big concern. A CEO that doesn't vote is really doing what a CEO is supposed to do, setting agendas, listening to board members, moving forward. Policy sits in our chairs, not the CEO's chairs. That would change with a voting CEO who's an elected official. So I would advocate for, and I appreciate all sides of this issue, I would advocate for the option of this board to debate and decide whether or not we go inside or outside and the term of the particular chair. Thank you.
Anything else on this? I'm sorry, Mr. Minow.
You know, I got to say that Jim pretty much summed up a lot of what I was thinking of. And I guess the question is that after being on this board for 7 years, every time we've had an opportunity to vote on who the chairman is, we selected, Harry as the chairman. And if it had been somebody else that, like, for instance, he retired and somebody else came along and had the qualifications, we'd probably vote for them too because the job has been done very, very well. And one of the things that's happened is that we've seemed to almost always have a former elected official who sat in the seat, and that has always brought some type of, I won't say accountability, but it's a different perspective, and the perspective is from an elected position. I'm not comfortable, I'm comfortable either way, having an elected official or a non-elected official. I think it's a good idea in some ways to have somebody who doesn't have a full-time job, because I know how it is being retired and all the things I have to do as a mayor. And quite frankly, one of the reasons why I do this is because my colleagues on the city council, they can't be all the different places that I am. And I even have trouble sometimes getting around everything. And most of you who know me well know that I'm almost everywhere. So having someone who is unencumbered, if I can use that word, and is accountable to this board, and can be removed, like Jim says, means a lot. It really does mean a lot. But being a non-voting member, and I like the idea of having the second person from Chula Vista because it's another voice. Making the chair a non-voting person is a good idea. But they can get the job done. That's all I have to say about that.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you said it because both you and Jim also have said a lot of the notes that I've written down. Excuse me for my voice. I don't understand why preclude the option by Sacramento legislation. I mean, if it's up to this board, and for the reasons that the two of you have already stated, and you look at someone with the commitment, expertise, the time, the institutional knowledge, and I think a former elected, Harry has served the city in two terms on the council and, you know, has a lot of that institutional knowledge where a lot of us elected officials, we come and go. You know, we have newly elected with 1 year experience, two, you know, a few. And I think Mr. Mathis has more experience than many of us here combined, combined right now. And so I don't see the reason why we should preclude this. We vote on it. The option of maybe non-voting. And then, geez, I need a sip of water. Hold on a second.
I get jumped up, too.
I don't know what is wrong with me. I actually got a good night's sleep for once. And also, as far as having the second member from Chula Vista, if the rationale is based on population, then Mr. Roberts makes a good point. And so if that's the only rationale, then that doesn't hold up, and there should be two members from the county and two members from Chula Vista. But if it's only by population, that it doesn't make sense to me. So thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Alvarez.
All right. So people are talking about why have Sacramento dictate who does what and what we do here. The reason this exists is because Sacramento created a statute that created this board. And so that's why this exists. And so if you want to change what happens, you go to Sacramento. We're not self-governed. We're not our own little fiefdom. We have the authority by the state to do the work that we do. Second, it's interesting to hear people talk about how we should have someone who's not elected because people are busy. And same people talk about how great the SANDAG structure is where we don't have an outside appointed official. It's someone within its own body. I just can't believe you can sit here with a straight face and talk about that. Third, and this is where I'll stop, we discussed this already. This, to me, is a really sneaky way of bringing back an issue that we already discussed. We requested a change, the changes that we requested. We discussed this the last time. We've decided to vote the way we did, and here it is again. So I will make a motion now that we do not make any changes to the language in the bill, continue supporting it as it is, as it relates to the chairperson language in the legislation. That would be my motion.
Second.
Before we take a vote, I do have a change that I think that is important, and that's in addressing the four-year term. And I think that what we're not taking into account there is the terms of office of the people that are on the board. So you may have somebody that's highly qualified to be the chair, and they only have two more years to go on their term. So I think in that regard, relative to the term of office, we have to retain that flexibility to make sure that we get a person that is really qualified and willing to be the chair. Thank you.
Any discussion on the motion? I will then call for a vote. All in favor of the motion, which basically ends this discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Let's go for a hand vote because it will be split. All in favor of the motion? Opposed?
I'm going to call for a weighted vote.
Well, that's your privilege. Who is joining you on this?
The clerk needs to pull up the formula spreadsheet.
Pardon?
Just give us a second.
Yeah.
We're pulling it up, the calculation. Okay. You ready?
All right. In other words, before we can vote, I have to know what other jurisdictions are supporting the weighted vote.
Mary's asked.
We've had
to. There needs to be a motion, and somebody needs to second.
It was moved and seconded by Alvarez.
Okay.
So.
Okay. All in favor of the motion, please raise your hands. Opposed to the motion? Mr. Roberts opposes.
So the weighted vote passes.
It passes with 53.5.
Okay, the weighted vote passes. That's the end of the discussion. And I will say parenthetically that that's what you can expect on all these issues. All right. We will move now to item 25.
Good morning. We're here to present a draft FY18 proposed operating budget. We brought, if you recall, last month we brought to the board a deficit of about $6 million on our operating budget. We have bridged that deficit. I'm going to explain those final adjustments we made, just a few changes to the assumptions, and then quickly review the overall numbers on the FY18 operating budget. We did make some final adjustments on the personnel side. If you recall, we do have 29 FTE increase in the budget. We're using a new software system for the budgeting application this go-round, and it calculates things a little bit differently. So we spent a lot of time really fine-tuning and reviewing that, and we were able to reduce personnel expenses by just over $400,000 in this final version. We reduced purchase transportation costs by $330,000. This is on the ADA paratransit side. We made the assumption that levels of service will be equal next year to this year. And then we just looked at the first 3 months of this year, and that came down a little bit over our initial projections. So we were able to lower next year as well by about 5,000 hours. It was able to save us just over $300,000. We also did our final assumptions on energy and electricity. That we're able to reduce CNG costs by about $250,000. We just lowered that rate a little bit based on the commodity prices that we're seeing for the future. So based on those three small adjustments, we were able to save almost $1 million from the previous draft that you saw. So that would still leave a deficit of about $5 million. If you recall, when we did the capital budget, we had been saving $5 million of TDA for the operating budget, knowing that we had a problem balancing this year's budget. So we've incorporated that $5 million of TDA in this draft of the budget. And then we also changed passenger revenue slightly just to fill in that last little gap. Now, this does include 1% growth overall in passenger revenues. We're not projecting any change to the fare structure. We're just counting on some additional ridership. Hopefully gas prices increase as they're projected to increase, or with the route changes from the transit optimization plan, we can generate additional ridership that way and generate revenue. But we do have about $1 million of revenue growth from passenger levels to balance out this budget. regarding Senate Bill 1. We'll talk a lot more about that later in the presentation, but we are not including any revenues for Senate Bill 1 in this draft of the budget. We will look at that at mid-year when we really have a better idea of how much money that's going to be and what we can do with that money. But we'll talk more about that later. Just wanted to say up front that there's no additional revenues for STA from SB 1 in this draft. And with these changes, we do have a draft balanced budget. Looking at revenue projections for next year with this draft, you can see the about $1 million increase in passenger revenue. It's 1%. Other operating increases are decreasing just very slightly, a $46,000 change. So it's just over $14 million for our revenues for things like advertising and energy credits and land management revenues, things like that. On the subsidy side, with federal revenue, we talked last month how we're increasing the federal revenue in the operating budget. That's just a strategy on how we spend that those federal dollars in our reimbursement. So it's not really new revenue, it's just how we're spending it. TDA is decreasing slightly. Transnet is increasing by about 6%. This is both formula revenue increases and then also some reimbursement of the Transnet operating routes. We're getting higher reimbursement next year just due to general inflation. So in total, subsidy is growing by about $3 million or 2%. And you can see we do have $5 million of one-time funding listed separately. And in total, we have $6.7 million of revenue growth from in operating budget compared to the amended budget. But if you look at $3 million of that growth is that one-time funding, and $2 million is the federal preventive maintenance. It's just sort of a bucket shuffle. There's really not much real revenue growth in this operating budget. It's more artificial to balance the budget. On the expense side, these are the numbers we're projecting for next year, about $5 million increase in personnel expenses. That's a 4% increase. This does include the increase to the code compliance inspectors that we brought to the board in February, where we're hiring more staff and then also reducing number of contracted staff as a way to manage that services we provide. So without that change, the increase in personnel expenses is more about 2.7% rather than 5%. So some of that is a bucket shuffle. And that's why you see outside services on the whole going down by about $1 million. It's because we're taking some of that service out and putting it in a personnel line. Energy is increasing by about $600,000. We still have somewhat favorable rates on diesel and CNG in this budget. But that's basically what the projections are showing us right now. Risk management is increasing by $1.7 million. We're projecting another large settlement next year in fiscal year 18, about $2 million. That's driving up that cost. So in total, $6.7 million of expense increases. It's 2.5% increase. If you take out that one-time risk thing, expenses are only increasing by 1.7%, which is fairly low and aggressive at this point in time with everything that's going on. So we do have a balanced budget. The revenues are increasing, offset the expense increases. So just over $270 million in operating revenues and operating expenses for next year. We typically look at the contingency reserve balance with this public hearing presentation. The board policy set the target for contingency reserves with a balance of 12.5% of the operating budget. Based on this draft of the budget, that 12.5% equates to $34.4 million. In our reserve balance at the end of FY16, we had $34.4 million, thankfully. So in FY17 operating budget, the amended budget does not include any changes to the reserve balance, so we are at our target. And if you look at the chart at the bottom, there's been a number of changes to this balance over the last 5 years. We've actually added almost $13 million to this contingency reserve balance. Part of it was changing from a reserve policy of 10% to 12.5%. But the other part of it is we've added a lot of service over this period of time. And every time you add service, it increases your expense load. It increases the reserve that we're required to have. So again, that's about $13 million over those last 5 years. We've increased that contingency reserve balance. But before we look at the five-year projection going forward, I want to do a quick look 5 years going backwards. You can see operating expense revenues growing from about $105 million in FY14 to the projection of $110 for next fiscal year. It peaked about $114 million in FY16, and we've been slowly coming down since then as ridership also peaked in that period of time. Recurring subsidy revenues have been growing a little bit faster. As I mentioned, over the course of this time, we've been adding service. That's part of it, is the additional Transnet funding for a lot of that service on the BRT side. And then we've also had very good sales tax results for a few of those years that were well over 405%, where in the future, we're not expecting really that level of subsidy growth. And operating expenses over this period have gone from $238 million in FY14 up to $278 million. That's about a 20% increase, about 4.3% per year. It's a little higher, but again, that service is part of that. So the next slide, we sort of take a look at the costs and other metrics and sort of try to normalize them for service and passenger levels. So the red bars on the slide are our passenger levels. You can see them peaking in FY15 and then slowly declining since then. That's driving up some of the rates per passenger. This green line here in the middle of the page is the subsidy per passenger. So subsidy revenue has been growing as service levels have been growing, but passenger levels have been declining. So the subsidy we're putting forth for each passenger has been growing at about 8% a year over this five-year period. That's one of the metrics we try to watch. That's how we're using the public's money as best we can. The cost per revenue mile is the blue bar, at the blue line at the top, and you can see it was about $8 in FY14 and has grown ever so slightly to $8.22 in this FY18 proposal. That's a growth of about 1% a year based on the service we're putting on the street. It's under 1% a year. That's a very favorable number. And then the average fare is that purple line at the bottom that is almost totally flat. It was $1.02 in FY14. It's $1.06 now for the last couple of years. Without any changes to the fare structure, that number really shouldn't change. It would be the mix of how people are using our fares. But without any changes to that, it's pretty much a very constant number over these last 5 years. So that's the look back. Now, just some of the difference between look back and look forward. We are expecting subsidy revenue to grow in the out period. It has been very strong on the sales tax side. It's been very strong on adding service side, but we're not going to see that continuing. I don't have any SB1 revenue in this projection. In this first projection, you'll see. We'll get to that in a second. We are also seeing operating trend. You saw that peak in FY15 and decline since then. So we're sort of putting a more slower growth on that in the out years, as you'll see. And then we're also expecting higher than normal general inflation. We had the minimum wage increases that are on the books for the next 4 or 5 years. We now have diesel and gas increases that are probably going to be passed on to all consumers as everything costs more for everybody. And then also in the last 5 year look back, we had very favorable energy prices. We had diesel prices that were very low for a number of those years. We had CNG prices that were the lowest in the last 20 years. So that's all going to ratchet up over the next out 5 years, most likely, based on the projections that we've seen from the Department of Energy. Another thing to note about this projection that we're going to show you is we're not putting any service level changes in the out years. We're talking about changing service levels for FY18. We also have South Bay BRT that is coming online in FY19. The BRT is a Transnet funded project, so costs will increase. Passenger revenue should increase, but the difference will be made up by Transnet, so it's sort of a net sum game, net zero game. Same thing with Midcoast. That should come online in FY22, which is in this five-year lookout, but we're not putting those dollars in yet because it's going to raise expenses, raise passenger levels, and raise Transnet. It'll all balance out. So it sort of gives you a look of what today looks like based on the increased costs and increased revenues. So if this is what it looks like, $110 million in operating revenues in FY18. We have that growing slightly in 19 and then about 2% growth in the out years. So it grows to about $117 million at the end of the five-year period. Subsidy revenues growing just under 3% on that. We have TDA and Transnet growing by 3.5% in these projections for the out years. That's a little bit less than what Sandag is using. But it's a little bit higher than we normally project because if inflation does increase, that'll increase the subsidy, the sales tax revenues as well. So we did have that number a little higher than we typically do. We're assuming federal revenue grows by 1.5%. We don't really have much direction on that yet with the new administration, so we're using assumptions that we've used in the past. And then STA revenue in the operating budget, and STA revenue in general, is remaining flat. I mean, this does not include any SB1 revenue, again. Expense assumptions are today's level of service. As I mentioned, annual expense growth is about 2.8%, looking at what we know is going to happen in contract services, contracted rates, and what we think is going to happen in energy and personnel. We're coming up with about 2.8% growth in expenses. So as you can see, expenses are growing faster than revenues are, and we're starting this period, FY18, with a net operating deficit of about $5 million. So with expenses growing faster than revenues, that's growing over the next couple of years by $2 to $3 million a year, and we get to a deficit of about $12 million, almost $12 million at the end of FY22. Now, so this does not include SB1. So then we'll talk about SB1 and then layer that in. So SB1 is Senate Bill 1. It was approved by the state legislature in early April and then approved by the governor in late April. There is a trailer bill still pending for constitutional protection of these funds that is probably a year away. There is also an attempt to rescind this SB1 that just passed, currently underway as well, but that will be subject to popular vote in the future. So what the changes that we do know about based on SB1 is there will be increases to funding for state transit assistance, or STA. There will be an incremental sales tax on diesel fuel sales dedicated to state transit assistance. That increases from 3.5% to 7.5%. The 3.5 of that 4 is directly related, allocated to transit. So the projections are this piece alone generates an additional pool of money, about $250 million. And that will be formula based, based on the rules that they use today to allocate STA funding. And it can be used for either operating funding or capital funding. This pool of money can. So based on that pool size and our revenue we typically receive from STA, it's about $12 million a year for MTS. Now, it doesn't go into effect until November 1st. So we wouldn't see any cash, probably not until February of 2018. So we can estimate that it'll be about $6 million next year, but we just don't really know at this point. And we won't get cash until even we're sort of done with the amended budget at that point in time. So we're going to be guessing then. No point in guessing on it now. We'll just wait till the amended budget and sort of address it then, is our thought. There is another piece of funding related to SB1. It's a new transportation improvement fee under the vehicle licensing fee law. This would generate about $105 million that will be added to the STA program. And this will also be formula funding, so it's automatically shared based on the formulas they have. But this pot of money will just be for capital, for state of good repair type projects. So it's not anything we can use in the operating budget. Based on the formula, we should get about $5 million a year. This does not go into effect until January 1. So we don't even know when we'd actually receive any disbursements from this. So we're just planning on delaying this decision until FY19 CIP, since it's next year's capital. We'll just do it in arrears and include it in the budget after we've received it. That's our thought. There's another portion of that pool of money that is dedicated to transit and intercity rail capital pool. That is a competitive or discretionary program, so you have to submit projects for this, and they have to get approved and awarded. We did get some money through this program for our courthouse station and for additional trolley cars. The last year, we did not receive anything of this funding, so this will just add to that pool, and we can go after projects that primarily focus on rail, but also some on BRT. But they really are looking at reducing greenhouse gases, expanding ridership, or increasing safety, those type of projects that we can go after this money with. So in summary, thinking FY19 and beyond, we're getting about $12 million in funding for operations or capital, however we want to use that funding, and then about $5 million specifically for capital. And then plus we can go after the competitive funding. So in total, it's about $17 million to MTS based on the current allocations. So if we use the $12 million number for FY19 and $6 million for FY18 for a half a year, this is what the operating impact could be if we just took this money and put it right into today's environment. So you can see we'd have a $6 million surplus in FY18. FY19, instead of an $8 million deficit, If we did nothing at all, we would have a $4.5 million surplus that we could use in capital or use on service on the street. But even with that funding and even growing that funding in the out years, it doesn't solve our structural deficit. That money gets whittled away very quickly, even in this five-year period, whereas we're just delaying the decision on how we rebalance our budget to reduce that structural deficit of matching recurring revenues with recurring expenses. So while lumping this in and just filling the hole right now is an option, it's not something that the BDC, the Budget Development Committee, recommended at this point in time. We do have other ongoing concerns around the operating budget, primarily is passenger levels. We are projecting passenger revenue growth next year. Passenger levels are declining right now. At some point we have to hit bottom, but we haven't hit it yet. So that is a concern. If that keeps going down, that has a large impact on the budget. There is a fare study currently underway at Sandag that we're waiting the results on, and possibly looking at a fare increase for the first time since 2009, something we consider. Again, we talked about the ballot measure that's being pursued to rescind SB1. That would be a major concern. Federal transit revenues. We have a new administration. We haven't heard much guidance about what their plan is on for transit, so that's something we're keeping an eye on, as there is a large pot of money that we receive each year from the feds. The economy, if we do see higher inflation, higher than what we've projected, that could be a concern. We do have the minimum wage laws, the gas tax hike that I mentioned previously. And then whatever that does, the economy does, is it affects sales tax revenue growth either, which is the other large piece of our revenue stream. Energy, commodity prices, while we do have them growing next year, they are very favorable historically, particularly on CNG. We're still at a $3 level when it's been as typically used to run in the $4 range, and it's been as high as $6. There's a lot of room to grow there. Same thing with diesel. We're paying very favorable rates. We don't have much diesel or gas buses anymore, but we do have concerns on that. If there is some sort of spike in that, it should drive up ridership, but whether it offset the cost remains to be seen. And then zero emission buses, if we're forced to do that, that's a large infrastructure and capital investment that we would need to fund somehow if we're mandated to have zero emission buses. So the guiding principles that the staff and the board has operated under in the past is to have a sustainable system, and that means matching recurring revenues with recurring expenses. We operate under Policy 42 on the service side to have customer-focused, competitive, integrated, and sustainable services. We try to maintain the fare box recovery levels for that service, meaning the customer's paying their fair share of those services at the same levels that we've had in the past. We always try to hold the line on expenses as tightly as possible to keep this service on the street as efficient and inexpensive as possible. And then we try to fund capital at an appropriate level to keep our system in a state of good repair, and we've done a good job of that over the last 10 years as well. The last thing is to pursue revenue opportunities wherever they may be possible, whether they're naming rights or advertising deals or energy credit deals or anything we can to generate additional revenues to help offset the cost of our service and put more affordable service on the street. So those are generally our guiding principles and how we operate, and we think it's important to talk about those as we have this new pot of money. So we talked about just layering that SB1 money into the budget as a balancing structure, and that's not really the recommended approach either by staff or by the Budget Development Committee. The staff recommendation is to continue looking at the transit optimization plan and continue to reduce any underperforming services and then expand services in a number of different areas where we think the ridership will be in the future. This is coming back to the board, I believe, in June about the findings of the study and the findings of the reach out. And we are proposing more enhancements now that we do have this potential pot of money from SB1 on the bus side and on the trolley side of increasing frequency and increasing spans of service, things like that. And hopefully that can increase ridership and increase fare revenue and just make our system a little bit more robust. But that still wouldn't fix our structural deficit all by itself. We would still consider looking at fare increases
you know, since it has been so long since fares have been increased, as a way to balance the remainder and get us off of one-time funding and get us in a more sustainable place. So that's sort of the staff recommendation for the SB1 piece that that we can approach over the next 6 months when as we approach the mid-year budget amendment. That brings us to our staff recommendation. So again, there's no SB1 in the current budget, draft of the budget. The staff recommendation is to hold a public hearing, receive testimony, and review and comment on the fiscal 2018 budget information presented in this report and also included in detail in attachment A, and then enact resolution 17-9, which was attachment B of the agenda item, adopting the operating and capital budget for MTS and approving the operating budgets for San Diego Transit Corporation, San Diego Trolley Incorporated, MTS Contract Services, and the Coronado Ferry. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
You have any questions for the speaker? Yeah. Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you. Great presentation. A lot of moving pieces. Does this particular budget that you have presented here today include reductions in services or anticipate a reduction in services?
No, it does not.
Okay. I'll defer further questions and comments until after the public speaks.
I do have one speaker. So, yes, ma'am. Ms. Sotelis-Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, staff, for the presentation. Where specifically does it talk about any grants or external funding that we may be searching out? And reason being I'm asking this is we asked this of our staff in National City. Where else are we looking for the money? But I had heard VW as part of their settlement for, you know, some of the exhaust changes that they made in their computer programs for their vehicles, they're providing electric buses to elementary schools and school districts. I'd be interested to see if that would be a possibility, you know, if we don't know until we ask, but if that's a possibility again. So where else are we looking for money specifically, and if there's a page in the presentation that I can.
Yeah, there's nothing in the presentation. We're always looking for every opportunity for additional funding. Primarily it's on more on the capital budget side where you have a specific project that you can go chase money for,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of the projects are, you know, they have programs where, like the TIRCP, where we want you to reduce greenhouse gases or increase safety. What kind of projects do you have? So it's a lot of the funding is very specific in what you're trying to ask for.
Right.
So we do have our department, our grants administration department, that looks at all these opportunities. And if you hear of anything, by all means, let us know, and we can chase it down wherever possible.
Great, but there's not specific dollar amount. Like, we don't set a goal of $5 million, $2.5 million that it's seeking external. We base everything basically on that.
No, we only base the budget on money we have. And we are obviously chasing it down, and when we get it, we'll add it to the budget, but we will not put any goals of money that we are not expecting to receive. We're not confident that we're going to receive.
Can I just clarify that?
Yeah.
So this is the operating budget. We already passed the capital budget, okay, several months ago. So typically, as we go throughout the year and we find out opportunities to apply for grants, we're very aggressive about it. We do every single one that we can possibly do. So let's say we get a grant that would submitting it for new buses.
Right.
Okay. So we would apply that. If we got it, then we would just take that money and buy the buses with it. And the money that we had in the budget, we would keep there or reallocate it.
Would it be used for maintenance and upkeep for those buses?
Well, it could, because you're really getting complicated. But generally speaking,
I'm asking clarification. Yeah, I want to make sure that we're...
generally speaking, it would stay in the capital budget. I mean, we do use some federal money that is supposed to be for capital for operating in the sense that whatever capital asset we buy, we can use those federal dollars to maintain that asset. We do about $24 million a year, right? $24 million? $23 million?
$33 million?
Yeah, a year.
So 24 or 33?
Well, that's another confusing thing. We use 33. Technically speaking, we use 33, but we offset TDA money to do that. We always try to use federal money first.
Of course.
Because it's using other people's money.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do operating expenses, we can burn all that money in a single budget year. Whereas if you do capital, you know, a capital project may take 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. So we'd rather use the federal money quickest and then save our money to use on the capital projects.
Okay, well, thank you for the clarification. And again, my question was, you know, whose external money are we using? And the fact that if we as an entity are setting goals for ourselves, so there's nothing that says and precludes us from doing that.
No.
And again, if we're able to get to that point where we're thinking outside the box and forward thinking, I think it gives us, you know, an advantage.
Well, we were very aggressive with the state money on 9 cars in the courthouse station. What was the total of that grant? 20-something million?
It was 36 million.
36 million.
Yeah.
Mr. Mendo.
I'd just like to also put into perspective, we talked a little bit about this, if I recall, at the Budget Development Committee meeting. But for instance, I think it was CARB is now kind of talking about going to all these electric buses and stuff. And didn't we talk about in order to do that, we also would pretty much have to retool our maintenance and fueling and all that. So wasn't it like a huge number, like $700 million or something, to do all those infrastructure changes? Am I remembering that incorrectly or correctly?
No, it's correct.
Okay, so even if we, just to let you know, even if we got a bunch of buses from VW, chances of us keeping them in service, because we don't have the infrastructure to keep them charged, we'd rather get them to pay for the infrastructure changes first and then get the buses later, I think. So it is like, I know it's kind of funny to hear Paul say, well, it's kind of complicated, but sitting in on the budget hearings and the committee meetings and getting kind of like into the minutia of it, if I can use that word, is very interesting.
It's chicken or the egg. You know, do we go first, get the buses, build the infrastructure, you know, to complement what we have, and then expand, or do we wait, get the infrastructure first? And sometimes we need those catalytic programs to really share, you know what, we're going to make the difference. And if the money's out there, again, do we chase the money or does the money chase us? You know, that's where we as policymakers can help set that. You know.
Well, you make a good point, though, going after $2 to $5 million whenever you can. That's really not much to help a $750 million project is the only thing. So we have to really be careful about it. Not to rain on your idea, because it is a great idea, but we have to really keep those for the smaller ideas, so to speak. Comes up with $1 billion, we're happy to do it, I think.
In the past, we've given presentations to the board about electric buses. I'd be more than happy to fill you in, okay?
Yeah, Mr. Alvarez.
Just a quick question. Did SB1 require that we spend the money within the fiscal year or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. So is it going to be considered as a potential source for some of the structural imbalance in the future? Or do you anticipate we use it all? That's still up in the air.
That's still up in the air. We're going to be coming back. Okay.
So our overall plan that we want to pursue with the Budget Development Committee and then the board is to try to use this SB1 money to create additional service and additional revenue. But we have a budget imbalance. So, you know, just broadly speaking, we're going to bring to you this summer the recommendations under the TOP, the TOP. We're also going to have the FAIR study. We're going to talk about that. But it would be, I think it would be the best for us if we were to take $6 million, and we're going to prepare a plan for the adding of $6 million worth of service within our jurisdiction, both bus and trolley, put that additional service out there and hopefully start to generate more ridership and more revenue. And for those of the people that were around in 2003 when we did the COA, that's exactly what happened. And we generated 12% more ridership in the year after we did that. So rather than just fill the hole and have it go away in about 4 or 5 years, we'd like to try to invest that to create more ridership for us. And then, but that may be that we have to do some other things, like reallocate service for more productive service, or even consider a fare increase in order to balance the structural deficit.
The second question is on the, was it STA or TDA that comes in, you said January, and so that's also not included?
That's SB1. I was speaking of SB1.
That's only SB1.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's all SB1. There's two pieces to it.
Oh,
one,
I see.
One's going into an STA bucket. One is coming into a new STA bucket that is
right.
For capital only.
Okay. So it's both the revenue coming from that.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you. Oh, one other question. The 83 line that was asked about earlier, I heard the question earlier that no service changes in this, but they brought that forward, and I just want to clarify that's not.
It's part of what you would presumably hear discussing the TOP.
Oh, but that decision comes later.
Thank you. This summer.
Okay. I'm sorry, Ms. Gomez.
Yes. Two things. One is I'm still not understanding the increase on passenger revenue when there's a passenger usage decrease.
We're projecting growth in passengers next year. We've been declining for 2 years. Typically, in the past, we've never declined 3 years in a row. We have higher gas prices. We're just hoping that ridership's going to grow.
Okay. So that's based on that,
based
right?
on that.
Okay. Got it.
Modestly. Yeah. 1%. Yeah.
Okay, and then second, on the recommendation, there's a mention of attachment B. I couldn't find attachment B on the documents that were given to us. And us three have been looking for it.
I have it if we want to make a copy of it.
Oh.
It's the resolution.
Oh.
It looks.
Okay, got it.
Can we make a copy real quick? I can pull it up, I guess. Just
wait. Why don't you give Elizabeth the copy? Maybe it.
Okay, I do have a speaker on this, so while we're waiting for the resolution to present itself, I'll call on this. You have a question? Okay. I'd like to call Paul Holloway to the podium. Mr. Holloway.
Hi, I'm Paul Holloway, a resident of Santee and a rider of Bus 870. And I'd like to talk about how to increase revenue for your proposed fiscal year 18 budget by reconfiguring Route 870 instead of doing what the transit optimization plan suggests doing of just totally discontinuing it. Right now, it's a drag on revenue Section 9.03 of the budget regarding contracted bus operations for Commuter Express is the least profitable route per passenger, but I believe this all can be we can change this for to actually be to gain revenue for the general operations of general bus operations instead of having it be a contracted route. So regardless, I think it should be continued, regardless if you follow up on this or not, because of the congestion on freeways in East County will be really increasing with the 400-house Castle Rock subdivision on 52. So the 870, what it does is it each day in the morning it starts in the El Cajon Transit Center, goes to Santee Transit Center, and it drops everyone off in the Kearny Mesa Transit Center, traveling on the 52, which is one of the most congested freeways here. Castle Rock subdivision is going to make it, you know, just an absolute nightmare twice a day. And then Santee has been hit hardest by the cuts suggested in the transit optimization plan. The 870 is only reliable transportation for people from East County up to the northern parts of San Diego County. you know, you force them all into the trolley, even though the cost per customer on the trolley is a lot less. You're going to have a decrease in the number of people riding. The ridership will go down because of that, because it takes me like 45 minutes longer to do that commute. Since I'm commuting from Santee to San Marcos, it takes me 2 hours, but it's much better than 1 hour in a car. So to keep riders like me who like riding the bus versus being stuck in that nightmare of traffic, I suggest the follow-up, keep this route, keep the Sandag's vision of having Route 870 service at least to Kearney Mesa. I know they suggested in their regional transportation plan that it would go all the way to Campus Point UTC, but maybe that's just not something we can do in the next few years. But what we could do is instead extend Route 280 Express, the Rapid Express Routes 280 and 290 that go, they originate in Rancho Bernardo and Escondido and go down to downtown. But all the buses are stored in the yard in East San Diego County. And all those buses, they go through
Mr. Holloway, your time is up. Do you have something you can leave us in writing?
Yeah, I can forward what I wrote here.
Yeah, if you do that, fine. We'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I just wanted to suggest that we reconfigure the 870 to go through Santee using those buses, the Rapid Express buses, instead of the contracted first transit buses.
Okay, so if you could give us something in writing that we can look at.
Okay, sure.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Excuse me, before you leave, can you do me a favor, contact my staff out in Santee,
yeah,
and also send them a letter so that it can be part of our record also?
Okay, sure. Thank
Great,
you.
Thank you.
More than that, Sharon, could you get gentleman's contact information and have Dennis talk to them for the public input process for the TOP? So we'll get the details.
Thank you, sir. All right, it brings us down to voting on the recommendation. I think the question on the resolution just basically is a legal document associated with enacting what you have seen. Any questions on that before we proceed to take action?
A quick comment. Thanks.
Yeah, Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you. First of all, well done. You have continued a long streak of very fiscally conservative budgeting. Although it would be easy to anticipate the funding from the SB bill, the fact that you don't and you never have included funding that may be predictable, but it's not in the bank, and I appreciate that. And so a job well done in that regard. Forecasting just a little, one of the recommendations made for a discussion point, and I understand it's going to come up later this summer, about reductions in underperforming routes. And I'm sort of predicating an argument that'll happen later this summer, perhaps. But in light of the notion that we'll be increasing certain routes to get higher fare recovery, I have a difficult time with the notion of decreasing access to transit. And just a forecast, I've received over 500 emails from the special needs community that uses the transit significantly in my district, in my area, and I'll be addressing that in the future. The issue as to revenues, increasing revenues, we'll also have a vigorous discussion. Every few years, we have a discussion about ad revenues and bus bus stops and selling ad revenue on that Poway may be amenable to having bus stops to offset any loss in potential fare recovery going forward. And that will be a discussion that we'll have after we get that particular survey back from Sandag. Having reviewed this budget and the projections, I would move If we have closed the public hearing, Mr. Chair?
It really wasn't a public hearing. It was just a public speaker.
Okay.
That's my error. Yeah, it was a public hearing.
Yeah, I'd move.
No, it's public hearing. It's my error. Yeah.
Closure of the public hearing.
Yeah.
And I would move the resolution number 17.9, attachment B, which Ms. Gomez has now had circulated to all of us, and I appreciate you finding that. Thank you.
Is there a second?
Second
by Mr. McClellan. Any further discussion? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Alvarez.
Just a quick question. Which is the line item for the bus pads? The concrete that gets placed on streets? Where would that be? Is that like repair maintenance services, or where would I find that? It's just because it's starting to become more of an issue on streets, at least from what I'm hearing. And I'm just curious, I'm assuming that's a status quo funding level for this year, but.
It wouldn't be in the operating budget if there's anywhere else in the capital budget, but I don't believe that we have any line item in the capital budget.
First off, that wouldn't be in the operating budget, it would be in the capital. But having said that, I don't believe we have any capital line item for replacing concrete pads at bus stops.
Okay.
Generally, what's been used is the advertising revenue that we share with the city in a fund. There's actually a fund that can be tapped to do those things.
Okay, we do have that fund, and we're just going over our budget at the city, and I've seen those there, and that's why I just assumed there was more of a regular stream, but I understand it's a shared revenue system.
Yeah, with the advertising. And I think that Sharon may know. Do you know how much money is in the city's account with the sharing of the advertising that they could use to do concrete bus pads?
If you guys can get that to us, that'd be great.
Yeah, I thought it was a couple million, but
that would be really helpful. Thank you. You don't have to get that now. Later, it's fine.
But I can tell you that we're paying for the shelters first before the city gets into
those. Still be interested in what you give the city. Yeah. Like, what's the revenue that they receive? Thank you.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. No further discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It passes unanimously. Thank you. We'll now go down to item 45. Nothing there. 60, chairman's report. I have nothing to report. CEO?
My only report is that on April 19th and 20th, I traveled to Washington, D.C. To be part of the Finance Committee of APTA. And this last weekend, 5th and 6th, I was in Reno for the APTA Bus and Paratransit Conference, where we accepted the Gold Award this year, which is the highest award for our safety program. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I just want to note, as a procedural matter, we've put, normally Paul orally reports his travel every month, but item number 61 is other reports that the CEO is supposed to make to the board that of things that he's done under his authority. And so we started putting it in there since we've been having some time pressures too, that there's a written record of it and it's not just waiting for Paul to orally report. So there may not be oral reports in the future that be in there.
Okay, under 62, any board member communications? Mr. Mendo.
Yeah, it's with a heavy heart I announce that this is my last board meeting today. Yeah, I've had too much business. I've got to resign and move to the state of Ohio. Just kidding about that part. No, with all the duties that are going on within our city, we decided last night at council meeting to make some realignments. And a couple of the realignments is this one is going to be taken over by the current alternate, who is Ron Hall. He's got a couple years, a little over 2 years on our council, so he'll need some good mentoring, although he has a really good base idea of what's going on here, and I'll be talking with him. But it's been a real pleasure serving for almost 7 years on this board. I've got to know an awful lot of folks, a lot of folks in the audience that come here on a regular basis, and so I just want to let you know that thank you for all the good times and
and some not so good times.
Well, maybe you can give Ron Hall some mentoring yourself.
Probably with not kid gloves.
Well, we certainly thank you for your service, and your presence will be missed, believe me.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item is going to be a little lengthy. I think under item 63, I have 10 speakers. These are folks that have waited. But I'm going to ask them to keep their remarks within 2 minutes, if possible. And our first speaker is Patricia Paler, and she will be followed by Lois Furgut. And I'd ask the following speaker to.
They're probably not.
Oh, they're not here. All right. How about Clive Richard? Did I see him in the? Yes, Clive. And Clive, how about, is Nima Sapasi here? Raise your hand if you're here.
Yeah, he's right there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, if you'll be ready to step up when he's finished, thank you. Following him, but just be in place where you can move right up when he's done. Thank you.
Am I up?
You're up.
Okay. Bless you.
Mr. Go ahead,
Chairman, members of the board, my name is Clive Richard, and as I'm fond of telling people, I live in the second supervisory district of this county and in the ninth council district of the city of San Diego. It's always good to see my representative here. The reason I wanted to speak to you, and I waited this long to speak to you, although I remember one member of the city council of my city said that this is the most boring part of the whole job. But I'll just simply say that the reason I wanted to speak to you is that on Monday, I got off the number 14 bus and I was crossing the pedestrian bridge over College Avenue. And as I crossed, I felt something hit my ankle. And I looked and I realized it was a skateboard. A young man comes running up to me and he says, "Oh, it got away from me. Are you all right?" Whatever. And I'm going, "Well, yes, I'm all right, but hitting people is the reason that they have a rule against you riding your skateboard across this pedestrian bridge." That event hit me in more than one way because I had been asking who enforces this rule that you should dismount your bike and your skateboards when crossing this pedestrian bridge. And I learned that it was San Diego State. And I contacted San Diego State and found out they really aren't enforcing this rule. And as a pedestrian, as a disabled individual, I find it rather offensive that I have to compete with bicycles and skateboards on crossing the bridge just to access public transit. I don't believe that I should have to take my own safety in my own hands to access your services. I find it offensive, and I find it difficult to understand why this rule is not being enforced and no one is enforcing it. This is just a problem. I stayed this long because I really am offended by this. I have a friend of mine who is disabled who says she won't cross the bridge because she is really afraid. And when I mentioned that to the lieutenant of the San Diego Police, State Police Force, he said, "Well, different people are frightened by different things." And that annoyed me. Anyway, thank you for your time, and I thank you for staying this long, but this has to be taken care of. It's offensive, and it's dangerous.
Mr. Sapasi, followed by Ingrid Vigens. I hope I pronounced that right.
Good morning to the board, Ms. Zaff and Mr. Chairman. I'm a cab driver. I drive a taxi. I've been doing about a year in the city of San Diego. And I want to start with a quick quote. Lao Tzu, the great Chinese historian, wrote about 2,500 years ago in chapter 57 that the more laws and restrictions there are, the poorer people become. And with that said, I was going to ask if the board can reduce some of the regulations in Charter 11, I believe is the number for the taxi cab. It's nobody follows those. The sheriff's department picks and chooses which ones they want us to follow, and they rewrite it in their own words anyways. It's just impossible to enforce. The other thing I was going to ask is if we can possibly start asking, and this is an old argument, but if we can get Uber and Lyft and the other TNCs to start picking up some medallions, I think that would solve some of the budgetary problems. And we have to follow those rules. As cab drivers, we're properly vetted, we're fingerprinted, we're drug tested, they go through a pretty strenuous background check, and Uber and Lyft do not. They just do this like simple little internet check. And there's been a lot of rapes, there's been murders, there's been kidnappings by Uber drivers. If anything, let's just prohibit Uber from doing this to our city. I don't think a punk corporation in Silicon Valley should come around and push us around and do this to us. We're the finest city in the United States, and we should stand up to those these bullies. The other thing I would like to ask is if we can get San Diego Police Department to allow the taxi drivers to go to Petco Park. Some of them block us, some of us let us go. And the convention center, they don't allow us to go pick up because they're not happy with their customer service, which, I mean, it's kind of un-American to tell somebody how to do something, if you ask me. And if somebody can ask the convention center people to allow us to go pick up at any time, that would be great. And that's pretty much that's all I have to say. And thank you for your time, and hope you have a great week.
Thank you. Is Ingrid Vigen here? Not here. Lorraine Layton? I'm sorry. Oh, okay. I got no reaction, so I'm going to lower it, yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and members of the MTS board, and interested customers. I've lived in Chula Vista for over 40 years and been a loyal customer for more than 20 years of the MTS system, so I'm very familiar with it. I'm here today to request that the 704 bus be continued to run on Naples and 4th Avenue. I think I'm a month early, but I got up at 4 this morning, so I was determined that someone is going to listen to my speech. As far as I have been able to determine, no traffic study has been done, and the results of a ridership study done when the 712 bus was detoured on Naples, which took away many of the 704 customers and made the study convoluted. In regard to traffic on L Street and 3rd Avenue, L Street is much busier than Naples, since cars come from both the 5 and the 805, which will make scheduling a nightmare. I haven't seen a plan for the bus stops, but L Street is not conducive to pedestrian crossing, at only at the corners where there is a light. Even the cars have trouble crossing. If the cars aren't coming from the 805, they're coming from the 5. Also, lights would have to be synchronized in order for customers in wheelchairs or elderly people like myself will be able to cross 4 lanes. Without proper planning, Chula Vista's pedestrian fatalities could definitely rise. And by the way, every bus stop on L Street will have to be ADA compliant, since this would be considered a new route and therefore cannot be grandfathered in as so many of the stops in the system currently are. This will be a big expense for MTS, and I am told that Chula Vista does not have money to fund this project. I was told by MTS Planning that one reason for the move was there was more commercial business on L Street. The only business that is not serviced now is one strip mall where I've lived for years and I've seen not one pedestrian.
I'm sorry, ma'am, your time is up.
The 704 now is convenient for the Telegraph Canyon Shopping Center, two 7-Eleven stores, Walgreens, Northgate Market, and the new 99-cent store.
Ma'am, your time is up. Could you please, are you listening? Your time is up, ma'am. Could you please wrap it up?
Well, Third Avenue is the other busy street that where the 929 runs. You do not want another bus running.
Thank you very much.
Third Avenue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lorraine Layton, followed by Noel O'Brien.
I don't see her. There's no other women out there.
Yes, good afternoon right now, Darrow. Staff? Okay. Anyhow, mine deals with some of the proposed bus routes, and I have some ideas. And I would like to talk to a few of you guys at the proper time. However, on two of them, which would be go counterclockwise, which is 871 and 872. On the weekends, instead of going down Douglas, why don't you open it up to go to the the regular route so you got people that will ride it and help with the finance of it. And the biggest one right now is Jablonski, Mathis, and a few of the other board members need to talk to Viejas because they're doing their demo on the whole front end and you can't get to your bus stop. Their tour bus that the shuttle bus that they have, cannot stop on the road. It can only go to the bingo hall and back. So you have to walk, or in this case, waddle from the far end of their bus all the way around down to get to the bus. And is there any way, temporary, you can open up the 864 where they drop off, where they start their route rather than saying no passengers allowed? Not even the tribal council and or otherwise knew about it. They thought you still loaded up. And it says, nope. So, and the rest of it, well, I'll be in touch with Mrs. Braggs and a few of the other ones, including Ron Roberts, and to discuss it. And as far as Devin goes, yeah, I have an answer for his question. But I'm saving that for when you guys have your rocks. Ciao.
Okay, is Nuala O'Brien here? Louis Parmigiani? Gary Wong? Paul Williams? So all those four are gone. So Chair Pro Tem, if that's what you want.
No further speakers, no further speaker slips. With that, I'll call the meeting adjourned. Thank you. Have a great weekend.